This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a program in the works at the University of California in Santa Barbara aimed at including more people of color in the technology field.
And I think we need to have more people that have a diverse experience and diverse epistemology about science.
Also, the SLO International Film Festival opens next week. We'll hear from a first-time filmmaker about her journey.
You know, my goal was to premiere my film locally, where it has a ton of support, and also local folks are in the film.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 1st, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. A section of Highway 1 on Big Sur's south coast is closed after a debris flow washed out both lanes. The road is scheduled to reopen early this summer, and the work to repair the damage begins today. KAZU's Erica Mahoney reports.
Construction crews have been hauling out huge boulders and redwood trees at the site. The woody debris came down the hillside at Rat Creek during a January rainstorm. It clogged the area's drainage infrastructure and the highway washed out. Now there's a 150-foot chasm. I visited the site last week and met with Kevin Drabinski from Caltrans.
You can still see the chocolatey brown of the debris flow that's trapped in the water there.
On Thursday, Caltrans announced their plan to fix the damage. I reconnected with Drabinski over Zoom. At a cost of $11.5 million, Caltrans will fill the chasm with dirt and construct a new road on top.
And then design it in a way where it really has overcapacity for drainage so that it can withstand any future debris flows.
They considered building a bridge, but that was more expensive and would take longer to construct. Repairing this roadway is no easy task. It will involve moving lots of earth. Another challenge? Working in the middle of California's rainy season. Until it's fixed, 5 miles of Highway 1 will be closed to all traffic. But Big Sur businesses to the north and businesses south of the closure are accessible and open.
That was KAZU's Erica Mahoney reporting. Throughout the coronavirus pandemic, many businesses have had to cope with closing and reopening as the state goes in and out of various types of lockdowns. But there are some businesses that have never reopened, either because they weren't allowed to or because financial strain forced permanent closure. KAZU's Michelle Loxton is at the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
For almost a year, Ray the Penguin has had full reign of the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Well, almost. It's more like Ray is taking supervised field trips to visit some of the other sea creatures, like the fish in the kelp forest and otters.
It's so pretty. Should we go keep walking?
That's Ray with Amy Greenybaum, who leads the team that cares for resident birds. Ray has this special luxury because since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the aquarium has never reopened.
Well, for the last 11 months, we've had no one coming in through the door, any paid guests at least.
That's Cynthia Vernon, the chief operating officer of the aquarium.
So we are down in terms of revenue. We've had zero revenue coming in from an earned standpoint.
That money is used to care for thousands of different animals at a cost of $1.3 million per week. To offset the cost, they've had to dip into their endowment, and they continue to run a donation campaign that's raised over $20 million. To cut back on expenses, the aquarium let go of some of its full-time staff.
We had to lay off about 40% of that staff, which amounted to about 240 people who were laid off. We're just heartbroken that we lost so many valued and great colleagues, but we felt it was necessary.
The same sentiment is echoed by InShape CEO Francesca Schuler. Prior to the pandemic, the company had 65 fitness clubs in secondary markets across California, including 5 in the Monterey Bay area.
When we closed in March, we had a little over 3,100 employees. We now have a little over 600. So that's an 80% decline in team members.
What does that look like locally for InShape? 260 staff members have been laid off. Two clubs have been closed permanently in Carmel and Pacific Grove, and the company is going through bankruptcy.
We voluntarily filed for Chapter 11, but needed to do that because we had no revenue for a year and needed to restructure the company.
Shula is optimistic, though, saying they have new investors and restructuring will help them weather the long term.
Don't get me wrong, as a CEO of a company going through Chapter 11, it is really hard. But if I think about the bigger impact on our state, it's the health of our communities and the unemployment.
She believes that if fitness clubs had been allowed to safely reopen more as part of the state's blueprint for a safer economy, that could have had a positive impact on health, particularly for those with chronic illness, because people would have kept their exercise routines up, she says. The blueprint, as it stands, only allows outdoor exercise in the most restrictive purple tier, 25% indoor capacity in the orange tier, and expands from there.
So we believe we would have been part of the solution, and the business devastation would not have been nearly as big as it's going to be. We're still not open, by the way, so we're still not open.
Shula is frustrated with the state. She's calling on the current administration and public health to open up dialogue with them.
I don't think small businesses can weather too many more months of not having sales or having restricted sales.
That's Rob Fairley, a professor of economics at UC Santa Cruz. He focuses on entrepreneurship, racial equity, and labor markets. His research on the pandemic has revealed the devastating impact on small businesses nationwide. Fairley studied 2 months in 2020, February and March, and found the overall number of U.S. business owners plummeted 22%.
The entire Great Recession, which lasted just a little bit over 1.5 years, we only saw a 5% drop in the number of active business owners in the U.S.
And like the actual coronavirus, the impact has disproportionately affected minority communities. During this 2 month period Fairley studied, African American owned businesses dropped 41%, compared with white owned businesses declining 17%. Fairley says there's a real concern that some small businesses could go under permanently, and adds it's up to local communities to do their part in supporting them. On the other side of that spectrum, for businesses like InShape and the Monterey Bay Aquarium, they're ready to reopen safely. They're just waiting for permission.
That was KAZU's Michelle Loxton. University of California, Santa Barbara student reporters Aubrey Valario and Miley Somogyi speak with Dr. Sharon Tedega, the director of the Center for Black Studies Research at UCSB, and Dr. Kenneth Kosick, a neuroscience professor at UCSB. They have a joint project aimed at bringing more people of color to the STEM field.
Dr. Sharon Tedega, a professor in UC Santa Barbara's Department of Black Studies and the director of the campus's Center for Black Studies Research, is at the forefront of three different national initiatives: the Aspire Alliance, the Neurocomputational Center, and the Award for Inclusion Research, to bring about greater intersectional diversity and inclusion in students and faculty of the STEM field of studies.
So the iChange Network is a part of the Aspire Alliance. There are 19 universities that are part of this cohort. And the goal of this is to change the culture and climate in terms of, I would say, inclusion, diversity, equity, inclusion. Everybody uses that word these days. But for me, I see it more as intersectional as well as environmental justice, because we need to have more faculty of color and women on the STEM side of campus. The whole focus is STEM. So we're doing this whole climate study just to say, what does the climate look like, right? And who can we bring to it as well? It's a lot of partners across campus. It's people that are staff, faculty, other administrators that are involved with this. It's change. It's a part of an iChange network. And you have to be willing to commit to changing the culture in terms of hiring faculty from diverse backgrounds in STEM. I would say we need to have it all over campus, to be honest with you. But the iChange network really focuses on STEM. It's a NSF, National Science Foundation funded grant, and is working with the Association of Public Land Grant Universities. This is the third cohort. And I'm just excited that we actually won one of the competitions to be accepted in the cohort to improve the hiring and retention of faculty in underrepresented groups.
Why do you think that there's little diversity in the STEM field?
You know, it's really interesting. I think there's a lot of reasons. It's complicated, right? It's a pipeline issue, clearly. But I think we have to stop using that as an excuse, because we have to prepare people at the K-12 level, but that still shouldn't stop us from preparing people when they come into the institution. But we do have to create a pipeline issue, because we know there is some retention and attrition that occurs when anyone comes into any academic ladder rank or instructional position. But you can't have it if you don't have people there. And you have to have people there involved. And you get all kinds of messages, even in K-12. I know, even as a young student myself, there is always these messages that you can't go in STEM. You know, basically, even if it's not said, you're not good enough, right? You don't think the way that we think. So you get these kind of messages. And then there is this assumption that when you come into these spaces, that you should ascribe to what I consider to be a very white male Euro-dominated epistemology, okay? And we don't all ascribe to that, but we're forced to ascribe to it. And it goes against the nature of maybe how we see science or how we experience science. And I think we need to have more people that have a diverse experience and diverse epistemology about science. And it's not focused on a very positivist, very Euro-centric way of doing things. We really need to change the institutions in terms of accepting these diversity epistemologies from women and from people of color. I mean, all people of color, Native American, as well as African American, Latinx, everybody that comes into these spaces, and APZ groups, everybody that has a different way of seeing things and a different experience, they need to be, their voice needs to be at the table so we can have more innovation, and innovation that addresses some of the issues that face many communities that are not included. That's what we see with some of the problems around coding bias, algorithmic bias, you know, all of these things, because we don't have people at the table and we're discovering these things as they go. And when you think about, you know, these algorithmic biases and these biases on how data is used against many communities, then it's real clear that we need to be there.
One of Dr. Tetaka's projects is the Neurocomputational Center, which is aimed at bringing in more Black students into the field of neurocomputation.
We have a group, it's mm-hmm. the Neurocomputation. So basically, we're working with underrepresented groups to bring them in and expose them to data science. And my position is data is everywhere. Why are we talking about the fact that data is everywhere? There is no one specific type of data. You have text, you have numbers, you have even music. I mean, there's data. Data is all around us. You know, people think about data and big data just only when it comes to social media and stuff like that. But, you know, you got climate patterns and data coming in from that. They're constantly pulling down, right? It's everywhere. And we have to look at that. And those things affect us. They affect our environments. We need to understand these different types of things when you're talking about environmental justice, when you talk about how our brains work. So that's what the Neurocomputation Group is doing. We have guys that are all over the world. We have about 8 of them right now that we've actually invited to work with students at the Center for Black Studies. And Ken Kosick, he and I have been talking about collaborating for a while. He went to the Hertz Foundation and provided over $100,000 for us to do this work and work with these guys and bring students in. And that's one leg of it. The other leg is I'm doing what they call a SEEDS program, which is students' engagement and enrichment in data science. And we're actually, I have an MOU, a memorandum of understanding with housing. I'm working also with admissions to actually integrate students in STEM, social sciences, and humanities to get them involved in this whole data, this whole notion of this data science work. And we're working with the library as well. The collab at the library, John Jablonski. I spoke with the Kristen Antman, who's the head of the library. She introduced me to John Jablonski. They're going to custom R workshops, as well as Python workshop, Bash workshop, to work with these students with underrepresented groups through the Center for Black Studies so we can just expose people to it.
You're listening to KCBX Issues and Ideas. That was student reporter Aubrey Valario and Dr. Sharon Tedica. Now we'll hear reporter Miley Somogyi's conversation with Dr. Kenneth Kosick, a neuroscience professor at UCSB.
So I know you're a part of a new program at UCSB that is aimed for bringing more diversity to STEM fields. Can you tell us more about that and how exactly you're involved in this?
It's a program I've been working with Sharon Tedica on at the Center for Black Studies. And we have, or at least I have been very influenced by recent events, certainly beginning with George Floyd, but you don't have to dig very deep to know that the history of that kind of racism it runs very deep and has been present for a long, long time. And I think what is good right now is that there seems to be, at least for the time being, a somewhat broader recognition of the problem. And given that, we wanted to try to do a little something. You know, the problem is enormous, and our contribution will probably be small, but not zero. And what we're trying to do is address a problem that I've noticed for some time, which is that that there's a big barrier to get into some of the fields that I personally am very interested in. These are fields related to neuroscience, and which is what my research area is. And because neuroscience itself is increasingly turning to computation, statistics, mathematics, there needs to be a greater knowledge and sophistication of those fields so people can build careers. And I believe that Black students are particularly excluded from that. I think that while some of that work can be intimidating for many people, it's particularly difficult for Black students on the campus, because if you're in a minority and there's something that's presented to somebody that they don't understand, it can be really hard to ask a question. And nobody really understands a lot of the more sophisticated aspects of neuroscience and computation right off the bat. Everybody has questions. But if you cannot necessarily turn to a peer group and you're timid to ask questions because you might be the only one like you in the class, then the obstacles become greater and greater, and they mount. They get worse as time goes by. So we want to do something about that. And we've developed a neurocomputational program within the Black Studies Center, where we have identified a group of guides who will take, that are some of them PhDs, some of them fellows in neuroscience, in the realm of neuroscience, and they will take some of our undergrads, some Black students, who will take them under their wing and help them to just get more comfortable with the field. And that, I think, is going to make a difference, so that when it comes time to take a class, join a lab, think about a project, do a senior thesis, there's a certain comfort level with all of the complexities involved in analyzing data and, you know, looking at a bunch of numbers, thinking statistically, and doing all the kinds of work that comes as a given when you begin a research program. So we have a little bit of grant funding to do this, and I'm very enthusiastic about working with Sharon Tedica to make this happen. We're still somewhat in the planning stages, but it's very close to being launched.
My talk with Dr. Tedica ended with a discussion of the vast amount of jobs in the computing science field that could be filled by people of color.
why is diversity and access for Black and Latinx students necessary in the STEM field now more than ever?
Well, all you have to do is look around you, right? Who's suffering the most in terms of technology? Who doesn't have the resources? I mean, we even saw what happened with COVID, right? When COVID happened, a lot of people, you know, could they assume that everybody got Wi-Fi and that everybody have these resources that they can get online. Well, no, some people not even comfortable at home. And we need technology for the people to understand technology and understand how it impacts our communities. That's why it's important. And our communities need to be involved with it so they can let people know that, look, these are resources that either I have or I don't have or other resources that I need. And then customize. We are able to customize the resources that we need in our communities. That, to me, is what's really important. And you can use any example of why it's so important now. We're being tracked more than anybody else in terms of the biases. We are being watched and we're being minimized. And we're the ones that's doing the service jobs and we're out on the front line and doing a lot of labor. And guess what? I think this past year, there were 200,000 jobs in data science that didn't get filled. You know, but yet still, many of our people are out on the front line working out there and not having the resources that they need and not having access to the technology in which the way they need it. So here's an opportunity to be here and to do these things if you want.
Thank you to Dr. Sharon Tetega for speaking with me and to Dr. Kenneth Kosick for speaking with KCSB's Miley Sumogi. More information on Dr. Tetega's and Dr. Kosick's work can be found at the Center for Black Studies Research website, cbsr.ucsb.edu.
That was KCSB's Aubrey Valario speaking with Dr. Sharon Tetega, the director of the Center for Black Studies Research at UCSB, and KCSB's Miley Sumogi's conversation with Dr. Kenneth Kosick, a neuroscience professor at UCSB. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is KCBX, Issues and Ideas. Welcome back. I'm Carol Tangeman. On this week's nonprofit story, we'll learn about a local organization that supports a few different programs involving dogs.
This is the nonprofit story. I am your host, Dr. Consuelo Mutes. I'm with the Sun Care Foundation today, a 501c3 located in San Luis Obispo County. Their mission involves working with the human and canine bond. And Dylan Jameson, the Director of Administration, is with me today to tell us all about Sun Care Foundation. Welcome to the program, Dylan.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So Sun Care Foundation, tell us a little bit about this organization, how you came to be and who you serve.
So Sun Care Foundation started back in 1994 and started with just one program called Alpha Academy. And that is a mentoring program that started out for young men ages 18 to 24 who were kind of falling off the correct path there, having some issues. We're not a rehabilitation program as far as drugs or alcohol, anything like that, but it's more of a mentoring program to help direct them in the right path as far as work skills, relationship skills, spiritual skills, all of those types of things. So that's how it kind of started. We saw that these individuals didn't really have anything for them. There's a lot of programs for youth, but when they hit 18, they kind of are dropped from the system, and then you don't see them again until they're in jail or in prison. So we wanted to help with those individuals to prevent them going down the wrong path. 18 to 24 is what we started out with. The program has kind of evolved over the past few years as we've seen those individuals kind of dwindle down a little bit in need, or they're seeing the need. So we've expanded to include parolees as well as part of our program. So parolees getting out and helping them with mentoring, which a little bit different mentoring, but it's still kind of along the same lines of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And so needed in our community also. Is it a residential program?
Yeah, so we have a residential program and a non-residential program. So right now students can live on our property for a 6-month program where they work for part of the day, and then for part of the day they're getting mentoring. So they're getting both of those. And then our non-residential program, it's typically we're meeting with somebody for an hour once a week, just helping them along their way. And a lot of those are Cal Poly or Cuesta students as well.
So when you say that they're working, do they actually leave the area and then go to a job and then come back and then you mentor, or do they work with you on your premises?
They work in our other vocational programs on our property. So we operate Thousand Hills Pet Resort and Mission Cars, which are both what look like normal businesses, but it's part of the mentoring program and helps raise funds to support the mentoring program and our other programs. So they work with dogs, or they work with cars or maintenance type things. So there's several options for kind of what they want their career to be in the future.
That's wonderful. So then when they leave, they have a skill they can take with them when they go out into the community. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's kind of the idea there.
That's wonderful.
And then they do build up kind of, they get paid while they're here. So they build up funds so they can save up to put a deposit down on a rental or that kind of thing. So they're ready to go out into the world.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful program. So you mentioned that they work with the pet resort or mission cars. Let's hear a little bit more about those programs, because it sounds like they're also helping to support the activities and the expenses of the Sun Care Foundation. So what is the Thousand Hills Pet Resort?
So Thousand Hills Pet Resort is a boarding, daycare, training, grooming business in San Luis Obispo off of Buckley Road. So that's just kind of seems like a normal business. We do boarding, daycare, training, grooming for the community of San Luis Obispo for dogs and cats. So people can come drop off their dog for a weekend or for a business trip or just for the day while they're at work, and we'll take care of them. And then 100% of the proceeds from that goes to support the Alpha Academy program and our service dog program as well that we have.
So there's a safe place for people to put their precious pets.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, all of our staff go through a lot of training to make sure they're able to care for them properly, and all the dogs are socialized with other dogs, so it's a very fun and happy place for the dogs to be.
Do you use people from Cal Poly or other places to train, or how do you actually learn, how do they how do you learn about how to take care of the animals?
Yeah, a lot of our staff members are students at Cal Poly that are in animal science or one of those fields. So they have a little bit of knowledge of animal behavior, and then we have our own internal training program as well for our staff.
So you say there's also the resort. So if people are on a business trip or something, the animals can stay there for a period of time. Tell us a little bit about that program.
Yeah, so it's overnight boarding. The dogs can stay for a couple nights if needed, or up to a month or 2 months or however long. And our staff will take care of them overnight. They'll be playing out with other dogs during the day. We have 24/7 staff on site, so there's always someone here to make sure they're safe and happy. Mm-hmm. And we socialize all the dogs based on several different characteristics, including the dog's size, the dog's breed, temperament, their age, everything. So we have 15 yards just for the boarding program that they can be socialized into.
Funds that come in help to keep the program moving.
Yeah. We don't have an owner making money off of this or anything. It's all going back to the nonprofit program to support the mentoring program and our service dog program.
Great. You mentioned also about Mission Car. I know I've heard about that program too. Isn't that where you can donate a car?
Yeah, Mission Cars is another program on our property that individuals that are wanting to get rid of a car can donate the car to us. And they can, we take care of everything. We'll pick up the car if it's not running, and then we'll fix it up. And then once we fix it up, we try to sell it, and all of those funds go to the program as well. So we have a full mechanic that works here and does all those repairs, does pickups. And then we not only work with our nonprofit on this, but we partner with several other nonprofits where they can donate your car to another nonprofit. And then we'll split the proceeds of that nonprofit between them and the service dog program.
So you take any kind of vehicle?
Yeah, cars, boats, trucks, RVs, anything you can think of, pretty much we'll take.
That's also another training program, it sounds like, is it right, for the people that are there?
Yeah, for any of the guys that are interested in that sort of field, they can go through training with our mechanic.
Mm-hmm. I also think you have another program, right, called New Life Canines?
Yeah, New Life Canines is our kind of newest program and the kind of fastest growing program that we've had. We do free service dogs for veterans and first responders who have PTSD and other related disabilities. And through that program, every step of it, we're trying to save lives. So we've partnered with three state prisons, and the incarcerated men at the prisons train the service dogs. Starting at 8 weeks old, the puppies go out to the prisons, and they're with them on weekdays getting training to become a service dog. And on weekends, they're out with volunteer puppy parents from the community.
If you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm your host, Dr. Consuelo Mutes, and I'm speaking with Dylan Jameson, the Director of Administration with the Sun Care Foundation. So a little bit more on the New Life Canine Program. You're saying that the people at the prison trained the dog. Now, how did they get their training?
We have three staff on our team that have been trained in service dog training. So most of them have been to Bergen University of Canine Studies. Cool. So they go through a whole program and learn how to train service dogs and have several other qualifications as well. But those three individuals go out to the prisons once a week and meet with the incarcerated men and teach them how to work with the dogs. Mm-hmm. So we started our first program at CMC here in San Luis Obispo, the men's colony. And then we're also at a prison in Soledad and one in Kalinga. So our trainers go out there once a week, teach the guys out there how to train the dogs. And then the rest of the week, they're practicing those skills with the dogs.
After the dogs are trained, how are they placed?
We do what we call a boot camp. So veterans and first responders can apply for a service dog through our website. And then we evaluate their applications, make sure they're in need of a service dog. They have to do a medical form with their medical provider. And then based on the person's personality and the dog's personality, we'll match them up. Mm-hmm. So our waitlist is not a first come, first serve basis. It's on if we have a dog that matches your personality. For example, we don't want a more assertive dog compared to the handler. The handler or the veteran or first responder needs to have a more assertive personality than the dog to make that bond work properly. But then they once we have that match matched up, then we do a typically it's been a 2-week boot camp. We've had to do it a little bit differently with the pandemic. But typically a 2-week boot camp where they're at our facility or at the prisons for that time period, learning how to work with the dogs from our staff and from the incarcerated men.
And I know you have different sizes and temperaments.
Yeah. We mainly use Labrador retrievers and Golden retrievers. We do some doodles and mixes as well. But we found mainly the Labs and the Goldens who work the best for service dogs for veterans and first responders.
You talked about how long you've been there. About how many people do you serve on an annual basis?
With the service dog program, we can do up to 55 dogs at a time. So that means we can have 110 incarcerated men working with the dogs. So there's typically two men to one dog. And that's a ongoing basis. So the men are typically in the program for 2 years.
Wow.
Because that's how long it takes to train the dog.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a rotation of about 110 guys at the prisons that we work with. And then as far as recipients, this year we're planning to place about 17 service dogs. So 17 veterans and first responders this year, we're hoping we'll receive a service dog. And then we do what we also call a warrior support dog, which is a dog that cannot be a full service dog due to typically a behavioral type thing, but they still are placed with a veteran or first responder that doesn't need a full public access service dog. So those individuals, there's probably around 20 a year that are placed with those individuals. And then for the Alpha Academy mentoring program, our residential program can hold typically 6 to 8 men at a time, and we can do 2 rotations a year of that for the residential program. And then the one-on-one mentoring program, non-residential, that's typically about 8 guys at a time as well, rotated throughout the year.
It sounds like you have a very robust program. Is it taking a lot as far as personnel? Do you have a lot of employees, or do you also work with volunteers?
We do rely heavily on volunteers. Each of our dogs has a volunteer puppy parent. So they take care of the dogs on the weekend, making sure the dogs get practice socializing out in public because the incarcerated guys can't do that part. So we have volunteers that are practicing with them at the grocery stores, at restaurants, movie theaters, everything like that to make sure the dog is fully rounded. We do have volunteers on the property that help with maintenance and various other things as well. And then as far as staff, we have about 10 to 15 full-time staff members and then another 10 to 15 part-time staff members that work in different areas of our programs.
That's a lot. And are you all looking for volunteers?
Yeah, we're always looking for people to help with to be a volunteer puppy parent. That is a bigger commitment, taking care of the dogs on the weekends. But we do have smaller commitments as well, where you can come and help write thank you cards or help clean up around the property. We do volunteer groups a few times a year that come in, clean up the dog yards or that kind of thing. We're always looking for volunteer help.
So how do people get in touch with you, Dylan, if somebody were interested or had a need that you could fulfill for them is in this service area?
Yeah, so if you go to the Sun Care Foundation website, it's sun, S-O-N, care, C-A-R-E.org. You go to that website, all of our programs are on there, and it'll link out to our other programs website. So if you're interested in applying for a service dog, you can go to the New Life Canines program, and that link is on the Sun Care website as well. If you're interested in boarding your dog or volunteering with any of that, you can go to the Thousand Hills Pet Resort website, which is on the Sun Care website as well. So everything, if you just go to the Sun Care website, all the different opportunities are on there. whether you're wanting to help out or you need help from us.
I just want to ask one more thing. Do you have another new program coming on? Because I'm wondering if things have changed because of the sheltering that we've all been through in the last year.
Yeah, over the last year, the Thousand Hills Pet Resort boarding and daycare program really took a hit. Last year over Easter, we only had 3 dogs overnight. In a typical year, we had 100. So wow. We were way down.
Yeah.
So over the past few months, we've been working with, it's called Gentle Touch Pet Training out of Aurora Grande. And Tia is a wonderful trainer in our community, and she's wanting to kind of take a step back and retire a little bit, still do some classes, but we are acquiring that program. So that program will actually move to our facility in San Luis Obispo, and we'll be able to offer group training classes, some other fun classes as well, nose work, agility classes, some trick classes. And so we'll have a lot going on at our property and more that we can offer the community with those programs.
Do people need to come from just San Luis Obispo County, or can you serve people outside of the county also?
So for the pet resort, we'll take anybody that wants to come. For the New Life Canines program, we serve San Luis Obispo County, and then Monterey, Santa Barbara, Ventura, Kings, and Kern County. So kind of central California.
Yeah.
We'll take applicants for service dogs from any of those counties.
Mm-hmm. So this is the Sun Care Foundation.
Suncare.org, SUNCARE.org.
This is the nonprofit story. I've been speaking with Dylan Jamison. He is the Director of Administration for the Sun Care Foundation that works with Human Canine Bond. And please look for them online at suncare.org. This is Dr. Consuelo Mutes with the nonprofit story.
A new theater production from Cal Poly students is all about being at home. The interactive audio play is called Shelter. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with Professor Karen Hendricks-Bolin for a preview of the production.
We're going to try something here, so just bear with me. Take a deep breath in. Now blow it out against the glass. Use your finger to draw a house. It doesn't have to be good. Start with the foundation. Maybe make it a square.
And then that's a clip from Cal Poly student Jessica Sater. Her story called My Dream House is part of Shelter. I'm talking with Professor Karen Hendricks-Bolin. She's directing the production. Well, let's hear about Shelter. It's the spring production, and it's described as an audio play. Can you tell us what that is?
It is an immersive, interactive, autobiographical audio play. So there's a lot of words in that. But just to start with audio play, it means that it's just meant to be listened to. Our hope is that our audiences who are likely be in their homes will have an opportunity to put in their earbuds or play, I suppose, our show on any device that they have and be in their space listening to a story about homes.
I did notice that the subtitle is What If Your Home Could Speak? Where did the idea come from? Did the students come up with this, or is this something you had in mind?
I was meant to direct a completely other play this winter, which I was very excited about, and I'm still excited about it. We'll just do it another time when it makes more sense. But this summer, even with COVID going on, my husband and I moved. So we were packing up our house and we were in the middle of just, you know, doing all the things that you need to do when you're leaving your space. When the news came from the chair, you know, that it was 100% guarantee that we could not produce face to face in our theater season at Cal Poly. So I'm in the middle of moving and packing and thinking about the space that I have lived in for almost 10 years. So this idea of embracing the home and those stories in the home and then amplifying those stories, again, it came to me because I was moving and I was feeling very sentimental. But then I just thought this feels like something that people can talk about right now. And some of the stories that will be born out of talking about your home are beautiful. Some are whimsical. Some are melancholy, some are hard, but it's something that is universally shared, right? That we have this connection with the place where we live.
And the students are doing their own recordings on their own devices, obviously in their own homes. And then are you putting it all together? What will the production look like?
All of the cast, all of the students are in their homes right now. So whether it's here locally in dorm rooms in their apartments, or if they're in other places with their parents still and taking all of their classes remotely, we shipped sound kits to each of the actors. So that included microphone, other, you know, technology to hook up to their devices so that we could get a more uniform sound quality to put into the piece. We spent the entire process of rehearsal writing. So there was a lot of writing exploration. There are pieces that obviously it's all autobiographical. So it's through the lens of the performer and their relationship to their homes and things that happened within their homes. And some of the pieces are stories. Some of the pieces are poetry. And we spent all of this time creating all of this. And then really, for me as the director and the creator, it was my job to put all of those pieces together and tell some kind of cohesive story. So at this point, we are still recording. And when those are complete, we send them to our sound designer, Elizabeth Widener, who is also our composer. And she and her sound design team of students put the finishing mastering touches on the work as they're all strung together. So when somebody listens to the show, it's about 45 minutes long. The hope is that there will be a cohesive journey that takes them through their home and maybe helps them see their own living space with a fresh lens.
There's also a fine arts component with related art installations downtown at the storefronts. Can you tell us about that aspect of the project?
We started to brainstorm about ways that we could all collaborate and work together to amplify the project. But obviously, it was an audio play. So Brian Healy designs a series of 20 different plexiglass boxes. And they are actually meant to be and will be art installations that are going to be installed downtown San Luis Obispo. So there's 20 different boxes, and inside of those plexiglass boxes are unique art pieces designed by the students, inspired by the play. I got to see some of them because they're still in process right now, and they're really, really neat. There's 10 different businesses in downtown San Luis Obispo that are hosting our pieces. So what will be available to anybody who wants to explore and see these pieces is an opportunity to find one, and then they'll be given a map. So if a person was interested in getting a chance to see all of these 20 pieces, they'll be able to walk around downtown and get to see all of the pieces that the students created, again, as a reaction to the play.
Thank you so much, Cal Poly Professor Karen Hendricks-Bolin.
Hey, are you drawing? If not, try it. Worry about the smudges later. Life is all about getting a little messy sometimes. Come on. Take a deep breath in and out.
The audio play is free and opens March 6th. You can find more information about Shelter on the website for Cal Poly Theater or pacslo.org. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
And finally, over the past several years, Central Coast pro photographer Brittany App has been working on a documentary film called Where There Once Was Water. Its premiere is coming up in the SLO International Film Festival, which starts next Tuesday. Former KCBX News director Greta Mart spoke with App, asking about the journey from concept to screen.
It has been quite a journey. I started this project, I think, 7 years ago as a photography project. And then 2 years into that, it became a film. So it's been about 5 years in total producing this documentary. And I was really interested in trying to tell the story of water, trying to, in a way, be a voice for water and also provide a hopeful story for people. And so that led me on kind of a crazy journey of looking around for folks in the state who were kind of doing things that were already working when it came to healing the water cycle, whether it was recycling water or ranching in a way that was restoring watersheds, or, you know, the reintroduction of animals into ecosystems, and feel really good with where I have landed and where the film has landed.
Okay, good. And so was financing a major obstacle? Was that, did you have to like raise some funds and then do a little shooting and then raise some more funds, or how did the financing journey happen?
Yeah, you hit it. You hit the nail right on the head there with that one. I started the project with a big Kickstarter campaign that was really successful. And, you know, I owe that to this incredible community that we live in. And so many folks jumped on board to help. And that was the main funding that really got me going and got me through the bulk of production on the film. And that Kickstarter campaign was in, it was 5 years ago. So that's what really started this project. And along the way, of course, as one does, I'd run out of money and I'd go, okay, well, we're not done with the film yet. So we better have a big fundraiser party and maybe an auction and some live music. And so I did that a few times and each time was able to raise enough money to keep going. And I think I have maybe $200 left. So, that part of it has been quite a journey as well. The business part of making a film.
So tell me about the journalistic part of finding people to interview. How did you approach that? Do you have a journalistic background, or is this more of a kind of a storytelling? Tell me about the frame of it.
I have a background as a professional photographer, but not necessarily as a journalist specifically. And so I leaned heavily on folks I already knew. I leaned heavily on my insatiable, curious nature and just trying to consume as much as I could around water issues in California. And then I also attended the Bioneers Conference a couple of times and found a lot of great folks doing great work around water and everything really through that conference. And just really dove in, I guess, pun intended, into the world of water, not really knowing what I was getting myself into. But each time I would meet someone, they would connect me to someone else. And a lot of it was just following my own intuition along the way. You know, a perfect example is I had this assumption that all animal agriculture, you know, quote unquote, was bad for the water. And that was a pretty simple assumption for me to have, but I made sure to challenge it, because then I said, well, wait a second. Animals and plants have always existed, and they've always existed together. And if our world didn't need animals, then why do animals exist? And there used to be a lot of large, you know, wild herds of animals roaming the landscape, and that probably helped the water cycle. So is there anyone doing that with domesticated animals that we could look to, that I could interview, that I could ask questions of? And so that led me down the road towards the Savory Institute, which is doing exactly that. They're mimicking the behavior of these ancient grazing herds with modern day livestock. And in doing so, they are healing the soil, healing the water cycle. And they have a hub farm here in California, way up north in Fort Bidwell. So I went and visited that hub, the Savory Hub up there called the Jefferson Center, and just learned so much about how it's our management that really makes the difference. It's not that, you know, cows are good or bad. It's the way that we choose to manage the animals that is good or bad for the environment. So it's been fascinating.
Definitely fascinating. And I want to learn more, but I guess your answer will be for me to watch the film, right? Tell me about how somebody watches the film now. How is it being distributed?
My dream throughout this whole process was to somehow premiere this film at the San Luis Obispo Film Festival. And that dream is now coming true, and I am ecstatic. And the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival is March 9th through the 14th. And my film has been chosen as the closing night film, which is a big deal. And I'm
incredibly honored to have been given this, you know, really special spot in the Film Fest. And we'll have a live panel discussion that evening as well. And of course, the whole festival is virtual because of COVID. But this will be the first opportunity for folks in the United States to see the film. It is the U.S. premiere, and it will be on March 14th at the Slow Film Fest. And you can actually get your tickets now. If folks are interested in seeing the film, that is the first opportunity, and it would be great to have a huge turnout. It would mean the world to me. So from there on, it is yet to be known. I'm waiting to hear back from other festivals that have not quite notified the finalists yet.
What about Sundance? How does somebody get a film in Sundance? Is that a possibility?
Sundance happens in January each year. From what I've heard, it's quite hard to get in, and it's kind of, you know, as the granddaddy of them all. It did not feel like the right goal for me. And so I, you know, my goal was to premiere my film locally, where it has a ton of support, and also local folks are in the film. Sundance wasn't really on my radar this year. Perhaps that's because I'm a first-time filmmaker.
It makes total sense that you want, you know, your support base is here. So it's wonderful that the Slow Film Festival is doing that. Yeah, and when you say big turnout, you mean big virtual turnout.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, you know, pandemic terms. So let's have a giant Zoom party. Let's have the biggest Zoom party of all time.
Let's talk about the pandemic. Tell me how the pandemic affected the process.
It definitely has affected the process, and I would say in a really positive way for the film. I work full-time as a professional photographer, and so unfortunately, most all of my work vanished over the past year because of the pandemic. I shoot a lot of events, and I have a lot of commercial clients, and that all just kind of went away. And so that opened up a really great window of time for me to put all of my focus and effort into finishing this film. And the home stretch required a lot of focus and a lot of time. And I'm finding now that it's done, you know, there's all the producer stuff that I get to do now, which is fun and different. It's quite different than the director role. So I'm just learning so much throughout this whole process. And yes, the pandemic has given me an opportunity to really dive into it full time, which is, I think, what the project really needed to get it over this final hump and out into the world.
That was photographer and documentarian Brittany App speaking with former KCBX News director Greta Mart. To learn more about Brittany's film, visit the website wheretheroncewaswater.com or check the Slow Film Festival site, slowfilmfest.org. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.